Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to another episode of Real Science Friday. I'm Bob Inyart.
And I'm Fred Williams, software engineer and creation speaker.
Fred, the latest edition of Creation Magazine is tremendous. It's the winter 2011 edition. It's got an article about beetles that blows my mind.
Oh, it's amazing. Beetle bifocals.
Why would beetles need bifocals? Now, these aren't even baby beetles. They're beetle larvae.
That's right, larvae.
And how many eyes does a beetle larva, singular, how many eyes does one of those things have?
12, plural.
12, plural. They have 12 eyes, but four of them are rather special. They're bifocal, right?
They're bifocals. They have two retinas and two focal planes.
Man, now, I got to comprehend that, because have you ever used a microscope?
You know, I have, but it's been some time.
All right, we have a microscope with our homeschool supplies or science supplies. And Fred, when you're getting up there magnification, you know, over 100, up to 1,000 times, the slightest movement of the fine tuner puts a completely different picture into focus. Something you were looking at is now totally gone, and something else you're looking at. And when things get so small, it's not like you're looking at one thing 20 feet away and another thing 25 feet away. When you're looking at like 1/1000th of a millimeter, like you're a little beetle larva, and you're looking at some food, you want to eat it. Well, as you get closer to it, or it gets closer to you, it'll virtually disappear, because at those small distances, you have to focus dramatically differently to keep your eye on something.
So what the beetle does, it has these two retinas, so that they can do this, what you just talked about, both near and far-sighted vision simultaneously
at the same time. In a single eye.
In a single eye. Wouldn't that be cool if we had that?
You wouldn't need the glasses you have on right now. Neither would I.
I got the perfect face for radio.
I've got bifocals. Actually, I've had them prescribed, but I don't like them. I don't wear them.
Okay.
But Fred, in an eye of this beetle larva, he has four eyes that each are bifocals. He has a retina and a focal plane, and he could switch instantly back and forth so he doesn't lose track of his prey.
That's right. It helps him capture his prey, which happens to be mosquito larvae.
Could you imagine that we have a creator God who took such care for the larvae of beetles that he gave each beetle larva 12 eyes, and four of them have built-in bifocals.
And the discoverer of this, it mentions in the article, she thought she had made a mistake. It was probably so astounding to her, this amazing design.
Yeah, this was out of the University of Cincinnati. The biologists there, they were blown away. And they say, this could give us ideas for imaging, for cameras and so on.
So once again, something from life that scientists are reverse engineering from the ultimate engineer.
And that's called biomimetics.
Biomimetics.
So, Fred, that's the beetle eye.
Okay.
Not the evil eye, like over in Turkey. They're all worried about the evil eye. They got these eyeballs everywhere. But that's the beetle eye that God gave to beetle larvae. That's astounding to
me. Well, this next one, there's an article about sponges.
Mm.
What's the big deal about sponges?
Oh, yeah. You know how they say chimpanzees, they used to say they were 90% human?
Yeah, they said our DNA similarity was 97%.
Right, and that's because they threw out over 95% of all the DNA. They said, we know evolution is true, so this stuff must be junk.
That's right. And now they're finding out it's not so junky at all. It has function and purpose.
The junk is not junk. But even with that, then they started saying, well, maybe not 98%, maybe 95%, maybe down to 90%, depending on what evolutionist you talk to. But now they're looking at the genome of sponges and, you know, the Great Barrier Reef down in Australia.
Yeah.
That's where this magazine is published. Is that true?
I believe so. Australia.
Yeah, that's right. In the Great Barrier Reef, they publish it underwater. No. So what they've done now is the University of Queensland, they have fully sequenced the genome of sponges down at the Great Barrier Reef, and they found out something really interesting from a chimp to human evolutionary perspective.
Yeah, they found out that the sponge is 70% human.
Oh!
It has 70% the same DNA, basically, as a human.
Now, that's funny because, Fred, have you ever had a relative sponge off of you?
I think I have.
I think we all have, right? It's Genesis chapter 3 explains it, but evolutionists would have to think that the sponge DNA explains it because it turns out that either we have evolved from a sponge or maybe the sponge evolved from humans. Humans like to go swimming in the sea.
That's right. So well, we talked about that our last show. We thought, well, maybe humans went back in the sea since our brains are so similar to octopuses. Maybe it wasn't wolves that went back to become whales.
Yeah, the evolutionists think that a wolf went down to the seashore and started wading in, riding the surf a little bit, enjoying it. Body surfing is fun. And
did the whole Mr. Limpet.
Right, the Mr. Limpet.
The Don Knotts thing.
Yeah, and it gradually evolved into whales. Well, maybe humans evolved into whales, and maybe humans evolved into sponges.
Well, you know, when you go to the zoo, they have signs there about how chimpanzees are your distant cousins. Hmm. Do you think King Soopers will start saying that next to the sponges?
Next to the sponge section. The natural sponges, our second closest relative. So, Fred, the truth of the matter is that the reason there is such similarity between sponges and humans is because we are biological organisms, and the Creator, our God, He started with a toolbox or a blueprint of genetic tools. And from that blueprint, He made all different kinds of creatures, including the human body. Now, that's not how He made our soul or spirit, because we are body, soul, and spirit. A plant only has a body. A plant doesn't have a soul. So we have tree huggers, but the trees never return the favor. They never hug back.
Yeah, so we've got common design, which makes perfect sense. That's a good design.
And they're finding out also that organisms that they say are evolutionarily ancient and very simple, and they say, why do these organisms have DNA for advanced regulatory processes when they didn't need those processes and they wouldn't be needed for tens of millions of years? What are they doing way down low in that supposed evolutionary tree of life that's now dead? So, Fred, they've got so many problems that are serious, fundamental problems with Darwinism, because God used this genetic toolbox, and from it, He created whatever He wanted to create.
Yeah, and you know, the fact that they have to use words like simple and prehistoric, they give this illusion of evolution. So if you don't look into the science, these things aren't simple at all. They're vastly complex.
Yeah, even a sponge, for example, is not simple. An amoeba is not simple. On the rock, you know, the lichen that grows on rock? I've read a couple articles in the Journal of Creation on lichen, and they are sophisticated.
Very sophisticated. In fact, Mark Armitage has done a lot of research on that and with the Creation Research Society.
Mm-hmm. And so it's really fun to see that now we understand better, even we creationists do, why there is the similarity between humans and a sponge is because as we're exploring genetics, we see that God used basic tools, and He used them over and over in different ways. It's like taking bricks. With the bricks, you can build an outhouse or a beautiful home or a five-story office building, all with the same tools and the same bricks.
Yeah, and if you think about the size of our genome, and I'm not sure what it is for sponges, but for humans, it's 3 billion of these little instructions, basically. Mm-hmm. So you take 70% of that. I mean, you're still going to have a vast number of things that are different, too. Large, little changes in the programming.
Yeah, and there's some creatures that seem to us to be so simple, and they have the same number of genes as human beings.
In some cases, lots more genes.
Yeah, it's just astounding. All right, so what should we go to next? We covered the beetle eyes.
Well, there's these
sponges.
These birds called moas.
Oh, moas. Moas are really cool. Now, I've gone down with my son Josiah, for example, Fred, a number of us went down to New Zealand because Bill Clinton went down there, and we went down, 10 of us, for a week to protest Clinton for his crime he committed against Juanita Broderick.
I think I remember hearing about that on the news.
Yeah, and it was on the news all over New Zealand, both islands, north and south. And Fred, we would go into a hardware store, and the clerks, they knew who we were and why we were there. It was on radio, TV, newspapers. And so we made quite an impact there. It was a success in that respect. But these moas, they're from New Zealand, and they're giant birds that are now extinct.
That's right. They went extinct about 600 million years. Oh, no, wait. 600 years ago is that, all.
That's right.
Just 600 years ago.
600 years ago, 6 centuries ago, these birds that stood about 10 feet tall, and they were flightless. They couldn't fly like an ostrich. These birds went extinct. And so everything that modern science knows about moas, it has learned from the remains of the moas, like bones, and one moa was actually mummified, and they've got many, 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 not only in museums and all over the world, but in New Zealand, many examples of these remains of moas.
Yeah, and they were trying to, with these fossils, they were trying to get genetic differences between them, but they couldn't. It was astounding, these evolutionists.
They had a hard time because they thought there were 3 species of moas.
That's right.
If you go to a museum in America, you'll find this very tall bird, a colorful bird with a big, long neck, bald head, and that's what they thought was 1 species. But then they don't always show the other because it's not as impressive. It's sort of a short, stumpy looking bird.
Huh.
And then there was a medium height one. Well, it turns out they thought these were 3 species of moas. Turns out they weren't, were they?
They weren't. They were the different sexes. One is female and one's male. Was
and
it the stumpy
the
little guy? Was
No. No. One was the tall one was female, the short one was male, and the moderate height one was also female.
Okay.
But they thought that these were 3 different species. And so with all the feathers that are still available, they began doing the sequencing of the DNA of moas from their feathers. And Fred, they finally got to the point where they got enough information. This one scientist, Alan Cooper, from the University of Adelaide in Australia, he said, "I've spent my entire career working on these moas, and we had the hardest time understanding the 3 species of moas." And he said, "It turns out that there's only 1 species, and the tall ones were females, and the short, stumpy ones were males."
And remember, they only went extinct 650 years ago. Bob, can I read his quote in here? I mean, it is, it's awesome. It says one,
sure.
It says a lot. Again, remember, this guy's an evolutionist. And he said, "If you're looking at our ability to completely understand human evolution in Africa from the remnants of just a few pieces of bone and some teeth, if we can't get it right 600 years ago, how are we going to do it 500,000 years ago with a tiny amount of material?"
Wow. So now, Fred, that quote is so insightful because this guy, he's an evolutionist. He doesn't say, "You know what? I don't trust the data." He has a commitment, I think, based in his theology, his belief about God, most likely. He's an evolutionist, but he says, "We couldn't get it right with moas." And he says, "We have thousands, if not tens of thousands of skeletons of moas that are extant today that we have to research." And he said, "We couldn't get it right. How are we going to get it right when we go back half a million, millions of years? And we don't have tens of thousands. We just have a few scattered broken bones here and there."
Yeah, a few fragments and teeth and things like that. In many cases, they have maybe 5% of the complete fossil. It's very rare to find a good vertebrate fossil in the fossil record in the first place.
Right. And so, Fred, this is so interesting that here's an evolutionist who is admitting that with all this information, we got it so completely wrong. We thought there were 3 species, and this is only 600 years ago. Now you've got some teeth. And what did they do? Remember Nebraska Man? Nebraska Man was said to be one of the ancestors of human beings.
That's right. They made a really big deal out of it. And the professor of the head of the American Museum of Natural Science, I believe.
In New York City, was it? He made a commitment that this is proof of evolution, proof of Darwinism, and they built the whole skeleton off of one tooth.
Well, they built more than that, Bob. They also built his wife and kids.
They built
from
his,
one tooth.
They built his wife, Nebraska Man's kids, and the tools that they used.
That's right.
How much hair was on their body, how upright they stood.
The kind of laptop they had.
The laptop and their civilization. They explained their civilization all from one tooth. And then later,
4 years later, something happened.
It was Nebraska Man because the tooth was found in Nebraska. Well, later they dug up the rest of the skeleton, the other teeth and the jaw and the skeleton that went with the tooth. And it was a pig.
An extinct type of pig.
They turned a pig into Richard Dawkins. Well, Richard Dawkins thinks he's a descendant of a pig.
And a sponge.
And a sponge. Or maybe the sponge is a descendant of us.
That's right.
It's possible, I guess. No, it's not. It's ridiculous. And so, Fred, this article of Moas and Men in the Creation magazine, very interesting. It explains, it shows us that the media and our culture has put way too much faith into the claims of scientists when they say, oh, we understand the Big Bang. We understand how stars form. We understand how the moon forms. Oh, you did understand that? We understand these fossils. We could take a few pieces of a skull and explain to you that there was no creator God.
Yeah, it's amazing the hoops they jump through, the fairy tales they believe. Sorry, but that's it's amazing that they can believe this
it's
stuff.
It's almost like it's an evolution fairy tale.
That sounds familiar.
Fred, you have a website called evolutionfairytale.com, a great website.
Well, thank you.
I was just on it recently. Really fun. I love the show that you have and the artwork in the show. Excellent, excellent website. But didn't we talk about this recently, about dinosaurs? About 500 dinosaurs went poof.
They went poof. How come?
They disappeared because the paleontologist said, you know what? We thought there were all these different species of dinosaurs, and it turns out this was an adult, this was a juvenile, this was a male, this was a female. They had double the species of dinosaurs that actually existed.
Hey, and they just have a new one, too, and it's mentioned in this article.
Yeah.
The Torosaurus, which is a popular dinosaur among dinosaur fanatics. Mm-hmm. Turns out it's just a really mature Triceratops.
So, that's sort of older.
That's right. Kind of a senior citizen Triceratops.
Yeah.
And so Torosaurus is no longer.
All right. Fred, when people believe things, it's hard, even when the evidence is staring you in the face, it's hard to say, you know what, we were wrong. And there's an example of that in this Creation magazine in an article called The Great Chromosome Fiasco. Now, this is really interesting to show our bias. When some authority or some leader says something, then the willingness to believe him rather than to believe your own eyes could be just extraordinary. This guy's name was Theo Painter, and he was a professor of zoology in Texas. He became the president of the University of Texas. And what did he say about our chromosomes?
Well, don't we have 48, Bob?
Don't we have 48 chromosomes? No, in fact, 23 plus 23 equals 1.
So wait a minute, you just said 23 plus 23 equals 1.
Equals 1.
Okay.
Equals one person, one human being. 23 chromosomes from mom.
So
right?
It turns out it's 46.
46.
But wait a minute, this guy preached 48 for many years, right?
Yeah, this guy said, and he was
very prominent person.
Yeah. In fact, he was the president of the University of Texas when there was a lawsuit brought by a young black man named Herman Sweet, S-W-E-A-T-T. And he was denied admission to the University of Texas. This is back in the 1950s because he was black. And what this Theo Painter did and the state of Texas, they dragged their feet on the lawsuit. And it took so long, they created another college for blacks only. And so they finally argued to the Supreme Court that he could go to that college. That's how long the lawsuit took.
Wow.
And Texas and Theo Painter, they lost this case. And so Herman Sweet, and thank God he did, he was able to gain admittance to the University of Texas. But at any rate, that's a side story. This Theo Painter, he's looking through a microscope and he said, okay, I could count 48 chromosomes, 48. Well, he counted them wrong.
He did.
That's somewhat understandable, but he counted them wrong.
Wasn't there pictures of this in the textbooks? Yeah. Did the caption match the picture?
No, textbooks would have actual photographs through a microscope of your chromosomes, and it would show 46 chromosomes in the picture. But what would the caption say?
Well, the caption would say 48. And you know, Bob, there's three kinds of people in the world.
Yeah.
Those who can count and those who can't.
Those who can count and those who can't. Yeah, right. Good point. Three kinds of people in the world. And so, Fred, this is so typical. I remember the story of Semmelweis, Ignaz Semmelweis, the scientist, the doctor in Europe who first began the campaign in hospitals to wash your hands between treating different patients, and especially after surgery, and he was ridiculed. He would go into a hospital where the mortality rate was anywhere from 10 to 35%, and he would bring it down to as low as 1%, even like a maternity hospital where the women were dying. They were being killed by this practice, and he would bring the fatality rates down only by having the staff wash their hands. That was it.
That was it, just washing your hands.
He was hated. He was drummed out of one university after another, from one hospital to the next in major cities throughout Europe, eventually driven to poverty and even death. He was hated over a period of decades because, well, he was right, but pride is so powerful. Pride causes people to refuse to admit what their own eyes telling them is true.
Well, Bob, isn't there passages in the Bible about washing things under running water?
That's a great point.
You know, the Bible, while it's not a science book, it's always accurate whenever it touches on science. It's amazing.
Yeah, science and history is accurate in the Bible.
The medical knowledge before its time.
Yeah, that's really fun. So that's the great chromosome fiasco, where we have 46 chromosomes, not 48. And for 30 years, modern science thought we had 48, even when the photographs printed in the textbooks would show clearly there were 46.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah.
Well, here's another story, Bob, that I love this one. It's about mother's milk.
Oh, yeah, that was a fascinating article. I'm glad you marked that one, Fred. What is it? We know that mother's milk is so good for a baby, but we keep finding out reasons why it's better and better and better than we ever thought. This comes from the University of California. What did they find out?
Well, they found out that 21% of the milk is really not digestible. So on the surface, that might not seem so useful.
That sounds bad. If a baby drinks 5 ounces and 1 ounce is not digestible, that doesn't seem good.
Yeah.
So what's with that?
Well, it turns out that this is a sugar complex. That when germs enter the baby, the germs they're going to love the sugar. They're going to attach to the sugar. It protects the baby.
Oh, my.
That's just one of two things.
Okay, so let me see if I understand that. So the baby is fed from mom. Mom is nursing. And, of course, the baby might grab onto a toy, crawl on the rug, his hands on a part of the crib that wasn't washed, and he's got bacteria, germs on his fingers. And where does his fingers go?
Yeah.
In his nose, in his ears, in his mouth.
Well, we were just watching home videos, and Abby, we were at this place in Winter Park in the summer, and she was chewing on a chair.
She's chewing on a chair.
On the arm of the chair, you know.
So our kids get germs. They swallow germs, bacteria. And so because 1/5 of the early mother's milk, the early milk, is a sugar that's not digestible, the germs and the bacteria, they love the sugar.
And they don't infect the baby.
They attach to the sugar, and the baby passes the sugar out, and the baby is protected in those early weeks of its life outside of mom's womb. That's cool.
It is. Another thing is that, you know, we've got actually good bacteria in our body. It's a really important part of our system, part of the ecosystem, everything.
Good
useful bacteria.
Sure.
Well, the other thing the sugar does is it supplies them nutrients in the baby's stomach and intestines.
Oh, wow. So the good bacteria, which actually coats the baby's insides, his intestines and all, that good bacteria needs to grow in the baby because now he's in the outside world. He's got to fight off all these dangerous elements in our environment. And so this 1/5 of the milk that the baby can't digest, you're telling me that the good bacteria likes it and feeds on it?
That's right.
That's just awesome. Wow, what a brilliant God we have to think of all these things and all of them before the foundation of the earth.
That's right. It simply is amazing.
Yeah. And so, Fred, we're almost out of time. Could we mention tonight's meeting at Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship, and then maybe we'll have time for the stickleback fish.
Okay. Yeah, so our meeting is tonight at the usual meeting place, which is Bethlehem Lutheran Church. It's in the chapel, and it's at 21st and Wadsworth. And tonight we're having Kevin Swanson.
Kevin Swanson is the head of CHECK. He's the leading homeschool dad and organizer in the state of Colorado, Christian Home Educators of Colorado, CHECK. And Kevin Swanson will be speaking on creation.
That's right. And so you don't want to miss this. That starts at 7 o'clock tonight.
All right. And the website is youngearth.org, youngearth.org. Fred, I've made it to the last few Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship meetings. They were great. And Lord willing, I'd like to be there tonight. I'm going to try to get there.
Yeah, definitely try to make this one.
All right.
Okay, so we're going to try to wrap up with the stickleback fish. We talked about this last week about how evolutionists, that was one of their 15 gems that proves evolution.
Yeah, Nature Magazine.
Because 15. Of this rapid, how they can rapidly become another species, essentially, how they classify it. But what's interesting in this article, they admit that this was a case where they where these new sticklebacks had a less likelihood of long-term survival. So does that sound like evolution, or does that sound like de-evolution to you?
Yeah, it sounds like information is degrading. And so these fish, survival of the fittest, they're no longer as fit. You know what else they said about these fish? They said they're able to live in slightly colder water. They said the adaptation was rapid. And Fred, rapid, they tell us evolution is so slow you can't see it. And now, like with Stephen Jay Gould, they're saying all the time, look how quickly they responded.
Yeah, and it's too fast for it to be due to, you know, random chance. This is design. This is programmed into the genome.
It's like we know that elephants run through our house very quickly because we never see them.
We never see that elephant.
That's right. That's from Jonathan Bark. Thank you, Fred Williams. May God bless you.
God bless you.
Hey, science fans. Now you can have all of the Real Science Friday shows on MP3 CD from 2007, 2008, or 2009. Hear Bob and Fred present the compelling scientific evidence that the Earth is young and that there is a creator. Real Science Friday 2007, 2008, and 2009 are each available by calling 1-800-8-NYART. Or you can get the MP3 CDs or the MP3 downloads at kgovstore.com.